Welcome everybody, my name is Wouter van Vught. Today I'm going to talk to you about how we develop SharePoint and not even detailing on the specific bits of code, but how we get the code that we do write into production, which can be sort of a tedious thing sometimes. I want to begin with apologizing a bit. I was running a fever only yesterday, so if I'm a little bit coughish, I'll try to direct my coughs away from the microphone and also away from the people sitting in the front row. Lots of ground to cover today, I must say. So I hope to be spending 75 minutes on content, a little time for questions. I'll be around in the Ask the Expert booth, so if you do have questions, we of course have a chance to go ahead and follow up. And another fun fact is a lot of the stuff that I'm going to show you today is something that we intend to open source and put on Coplex, so that other companies and other developers can enjoy the approach that we have on getting software from your developer machine through test acceptance and into production. Indeed, at least that's usually the goal. I want to go ahead and begin to set the stage a little bit with some of the key differences with ASP.NET versus SharePoint, which goes ahead and focuses a little bit on the difficulties and why there are difficulties with deploying and developing SharePoint components at the enterprise level. And with at the enterprise level, I mean that you will typically have reusable components, right? You might have some business logic layer you need to connect to back-end systems within your enterprise to go ahead and surface some data. And of course, typically you want to write these components only once and deploy them as parts of various products that you put into your SharePoint farm. But as soon as you go ahead and start to do that, you will notice that various teams might use different versions of specific components while SharePoint only has one per farm. So how can you go ahead and manage all of that? How can you ensure that your stuff still works while there are components being upgraded by other teams and something that you may not have been anticipating on? So I want to go ahead and start out with a little bit talk on ASP.NET and SharePoint. And before I go ahead and do that, let me get a little bit of insight into my crowd today. So how many of you would consider themselves to be SharePoint developers? Okay, that's cool. How many of you have staged environments for doing development? Right, dev, test, acceptance, productions, OTAP or DTAP in English. Well, we do too, of course. Why? Well, everybody does know that if you do SharePoint, it can be easy to break your farm. You can install one bit of code and all these sites will no longer work. So you better go ahead and test a little bit of what you're doing and not just go ahead and hit enter and get it in there, because you might not have any websites to show your customers anymore as you do that. And currently I'm being employed by a large-scale pension fund. We have a lot of pension in there. We have, therefore, a lot of IT. And we have a lot of websites that we maintain. So we have a pretty big SharePoint environment. We actually have at least two for the internet public-facing websites. We have one for internal things, the intranet, for certain clients that can access our intranet, stuff like that. And so let's go ahead and talk a little bit about SharePoint and ASP.NET, because most people know SharePoint is ASP.NET, right? If you do ASP.NET, you're doing SharePoint, vice versa. Many things that were in SharePoint 2003 were moved into ASP.NET 2.0 to go ahead and facilitate SharePoint 2007. So it's really something that mixes and mashes quite a bit. And if you're adept at doing SharePoint development, usually you're quite adept at doing ASP.NET as well. So how many of you think they're quite adept at doing ASP.NET? I do. I love writing custom controls. As soon as you get to that level, you're starting to do ASP.NET quite a bit, right? But on the other side, SharePoint is not really ASP.NET. There are a few really notable differences that provide us with all kinds of difficulty with installing stuff on a web server. And those differences I want to focus on for just a few minutes so that we can go ahead and talk about that. First of all is the deployment scope. And this one is actually one of the most painful things. If you do ASP.NET, you get your own little place in IIS, right? You have your website, mycompany.com. And under that website, you might create a virtual directory, and that is your little place. You have your own web.config. You have your own binaries folder. You have everything for yourself. So there's nothing going to be, like, it's not going to be like your coworker is going to install a piece of code that's going to break your website because your website is in its own run space. If you compare that to SharePoint, the run space that is being defined by SharePoint is defined by something that is known as a web application. That is a way broader scope than a simple, small virtual directory, right? So everything on www.mycompany.com is all running the same assemblies. If you have 20 site collections, you will have only one version of a DLL. And if you have shared components, and we all want to use that particular shared component, you're only going to have one of them, while these 20 websites may have been developed on different versions of them, so you better take care at managing these dependencies at a more proficient level than you would be expecting of ASP.NET. Because as soon as somebody installs a site collection, you have an easy time breaking others, right? So that's definitely a notable difference between ASP.NET and SharePoint that we must focus on. So you have one version of one DLL, and it's even more painful than the web application stuff, because check out how you install stuff on SharePoint. You have WSPs, right? The thing that we do to put stuff into SharePoint. And typically you would say that one particular DLL needs to go into one particular WSP. Because otherwise, if you deploy two WSPs that contain different versions of the same DLL, and you activate a WSP on one web application, hey, stuff gets overwritten, right? Who wins? Last one? First one? Who wins? No one knows. So typically, you would say that you deploy one DLL in one WSP, and now you have one version of logic, not per web application, but per farm. And per farm, that is a really big thing. Currently, we have about 7 web applications containing something like 20 site collections, and we have one version of code. And that one version of code must facilitate all these applications that are running on this one SharePoint environment. And this is definitely something that you must go ahead and take into consideration in the amount of testing and the amount of coding that you do to actually go ahead and ensure that stuff works. Because in the end, the business doesn't really like you telling them, well, yeah, if you install site collection A, well, you have a good chance that you might be breaking site collection B, right? They don't understand that stuff. It's like, why? We don't want that. And the only thing that you can really do to start really separating these things is to create multiple farms, but that's sort of an expensive venture for you to follow, something that we actually did consider when we started doing SharePoint development, to have a farm per site. That's kind of funky though, right? One farm per site. Not really doing that right now. Another thing that you must be aware of is that SharePoint, by virtue, is multi-server. I have almost never seen a single-server SharePoint farm, especially at the enterprise level, but even my own local do-it-at-home farm that I'm running, it contains an app server and it contains a front-end web server, right? Why is that difficult? Well, if you install something on SharePoint, it needs to be installed on all the machines, and we have had many issues with like a 4-server farm where one particular DLL that was deployed didn't make it into the GAC on one of these machines, and therefore the whole deployment failed. Why didn't the DLL was allowed into the GAC? Well, the GAC was locked down by a process that was still using that DLL on that particular machine, right? So you get into all kinds of installation woes because of that, and you do need to be aware of all the things that are running under the covers, while with ASP.NET, you would probably just throw it in the bin folder, throw new stuff in there, get going, and you'd be done, right? It's definitely an easier thing to do ASP.NET on a single box than doing SharePoint on the multi-box. Of course, you can scale ASP.NET to difficulty as well if you want to, but by SharePoint, it is implied you always get difficulty. There is no easy SharePoint installation. So therefore, we have all kinds of cool tools. So the last thing I want to focus on, hidden coupling. And here I've got a fun demo, hidden coupling. Have you guys ever seen a basic SharePoint command? So let me first ask you if this is all readable in the back as soon as something starts popping up and start doing stuff. You can do it. It always takes a little bit of time to load up that PowerShell. But have you ever seen getSPSite fail? Right? We have getSPSite. It's just a normal command. Why can't we just go ahead and get me a list of all the sites? Oh, man, my SharePoint farm is now broken. So what happened over here? Well, getSPSite is broken because I chose to install a custom security token service, and I have it secure my SharePoint site, and that security token service throw in an exception. And of course, if we do a get SP site, we need to validate whether I can actually see that site. So therefore, the STS is being called, and it throws a not implemented exception on getting the claims. So there you go, done, end of farm. And of course, as soon as any of my team, and I've got about four or five development teams working on SharePoint stuff, as soon as one of them installs something, it might be an STS, which we do install quite frequently, because we want to protect our sites using business concepts, right? And, well, what do you get? You get a broken SharePoint farm, which is complex to debug because, well, if you hit a debugger on this, you're not going to see the exception. It's going to go to the STS, which is a separate process, and there it's going to go ahead and fail, and it's going to fail back into the process over here. Eh, stuff happened, and it's painful to debug. So you must be really aware that SharePoint installation is not always as easy as you would like it to see. So I'm just going to go ahead and remove my web application for a second, not to mess with the rest of the stuff I want to go ahead and do. And that should clear stuff out a bit, I hope. And I'll get back to the slides. So SharePoint can be quite difficult because of all the hidden coupling and things that happen under the covers and things that are intermixed and interjoined, where you might not realize that it's basically happening that way. So we need to manage that, right? We need to go ahead and have an approach to ensure that that stuff doesn't happen in production. It can happen anywhere. We have staged environments. So we have development, test, acceptance, and production. And of course, you need to really ensure that you're doing the same things in all the staged environments. We have seen staged environments where there was differences between dev, test, acceptance, and production, especially acceptance and production, because then you're no longer testing what will happen in production, and then we see our production sites fail. And of course, if that happens, all of a sudden, 20 websites of 20 pension providers will no longer be available to our clients, and we have a few thousand people visiting our site, so you already will have some issues and some people calling. Not fun. Don't want to go ahead and do that. So I want to talk to you about our approach on developing, going from dev all the way into production, which is a pretty long way to go. And there's a lot of stuff I need to show you, and I've got about 62 minutes and 34 seconds left. So that is not just a whole lot, but I'm just going to go ahead and get going. The first thing I want to focus on is if you start developing reusable components for SharePoint, which you need to do because SharePoint is a shared environment, right? SharePoint is even in the name. WSPs are shared, DLLs are shared. It's all one big happy sharing family, and we all go down together when we go down. Everybody is the captain on the ship with SharePoint. That's good. So what we chose to do is, first of all, define something which is the reusable component, and we call that a product. You need to give it a name, name it a product. And basically, what is a product? Well, a product is not really a WSP, something that some people consider as the thing how you install SharePoint. SharePoint stuff, it's not a WSP. A WSP is one of the bits that go into a product, but we also have installation sequences. You might have some stuff coded out using using PowerShell commands instead of feature event receivers, for instance, which is important for high availability. And there's dependencies between products, right? If I install my website, I need to have these business layer components in there and that stuff too. So we basically have a whole set of products and interdependencies between those that we want to install in one go. And one of the fun things is that high availability. If you want to ensure that your SharePoint farm is, well, highly available, then also these products must be built in certain ways. And our installation guys, which are non-developers, they don't understand development, they need to be made aware of some of the things that people do. For instance, how many of you go into the GAC? Come on, you can say it. Come on, guys. It's not so bad. The GAC is whack, I know that, but GAC is whack, bin is win, right? Why is that? Well, it's SharePoint. It doesn't know how many web applications are using your DLL. It means if you go into the GAC, everything gets reset the whole time. High availability, not available to you. Another fun fact, feature event receivers. How many of you are creating feature event receivers? Stop doing that. Where must the feature event receiver go by default? Into the GAC, because it's being called from PowerShell. Right? If you go ahead and say install WSP, it's going to activate your feature, or it's going to go ahead and install your feature, And the feature installed event is going to fire in process in PowerShell. And PowerShell doesn't know about bin folders of IIS, so it needs to go into the GAC. So every feature event receiver that you build now means that you're going to do IIS resets on your farm, meaning all the websites DAO down. So we stopped creating feature event receivers altogether, and all of that stuff is being moved into installation scripts, right? Installation sequences. And that's definitely better. Usually we don't really have a activate my site button. It's all being driven by PowerShell scripting and all of the stuff that we need to do to get stuff in there. And we install something known as a product, which contains all of these concepts. So, of course, we put that stuff into TFS. Has to be. I love TFS. That's my favorite place to go ahead and store source code. And we chose to have a really consistent structure to TFS. Right? So here you see a bunch of products. I've separated it out. I've got two demo products. It's a website and it's an app. And my website is dependent on the app. Right? Our app is just a web part, basically. It's not really doing anything. And what you see here is a product. We have multiple production lines. Dev, that's the main production line. Development goes along that way. By the time we want to go ahead and put out a release, we're going to branch that out into a release folder, give it a name, R1.0, R1.1, 2.0, whatever. And basically, we can develop all these products separately. And in order to ensure a high level of separation between products, because the first thing we did was not have a lot of rigid structure, and people would just go ahead and go over here, and they would set a reference from this product over here in a project all the way over there, using basic project references and folder references. So now you get like a reference going to .../... and all the way back into the folder hierarchy, and of course, as soon as your folder hierarchy doesn't match up in TFS, well, that's about the end of your build. So in order to maintain stuff separated from each other, we also chose to go ahead and start defining our folder products or folders for the product a little bit more with all the dependencies in there. So we have a bin folder for all the binary dependencies. Of course, many people do this. Documentation, source code, and then we have that installation, solution, and support folders, which are our main things where we do our work. In order to show you a little bit of how that looks inside a live environment, I've basically set it up on my machine over here. I've got a site called Wingtip. It's the main development line where I want to go in and look at. We've got some stuff for building and versioning in there that we do need because we're still running the non-workflow-based TFS build. That's a little bit of stuff that we need to move, which we will by the time that we want to do that. And inside the installation folder, you find stuff like deployment scripts that do things. They might activate a feature. They might set up security on the site collection. I've got a whole bunch of installation files, and you can see that we have this separation going on over here between global and web application scoped installation steps, which is important because if you check out SharePoint, it also has global and web application scoped WSPs, right? That's the scope in which you can install bits into SharePoint. And of course, sandboxing. Don't get me started on sandboxing. You will not like it. And then we have a whole bunch of actions, which we named solutions. That is probably not the best name, but basically installer are the main commands, and we needed to go ahead and make the steps reusable so that you might go ahead and, well, define a certain step one time, and those steps are called solutions, which is a really bad name. It's usually better to name them actions. But we were too late to go ahead and change about 80 projects to go ahead and have a better name in there. So, well, you live with what you have, right? And inside my support folder, we find stuff that is usually defined or focused on what a developer needs to have to get stuff on his local machine. Because if you do installations, you want to do an installation on your local machine. You want to do it structuredly with all the dependencies that you have. You can right-click in Visual Studio and say deploy, that is one product, or not even, that is one WSP. A product might contain many WSPs, typically for websites, for instance. Here, if I hit complete.bat, it's going to go ahead and install all the dependencies and all the stuff that I want. But that's a developer install. It's going to uninstall, reinstall, flatten everything, ensure that all the bits are on there by really going for it, right? If you hit test, acceptance, and production, we have a different installation methodology that I will go ahead and show you a little bit later. So this product folder, that is basically the main place where people do their work, And usually the developers, they are sitting within support to do the installations, and within the solution folder we put our code, the SLN file sits in there. Then we have two types of solutions that are allowed to be created. The first is known as a normal, well, solution. How, why is it normal? It has the same name as the product. Why does it have the same name as the product? Then TFS can find it natively without actually needing to do something funky. And this is made basically the solution that is the product, without dependencies on the outside world, right? It's just in there. So we have no out-of-branch dependencies, meaning that everything is contained within that branch. The stuff that the TFS build will also get, meaning that the build will always work unless you have created bugs in your code, compilation bugs in your code. If you create compilation bugs in your code and you push it out to TFS, you're a dork. You shouldn't have been doing that, right? You should have fixed your bugs before you checked it. But we have no out-of-branch dependencies, and we used to have out-of-branch dependencies, and what would happen? Developer comes along, you don't know who is using your code, your reusable component, and you're like, I don't really like this API, I'll change it a bit. So you put in a new parameter, remove a method or whatever, and all of a sudden you break like 15 builds of other teams that you don't even know about using, that they're using your code. So instead, of course, we throw a DLL that we trust, we know works, into the bin folder, reference that is all within the current branch, meaning that if nothing, well, everything in the outside world can change, my build will still work, no matter what. And that is definitely important. Of course, it might not be the version of a DLL that you will find in production, so you might still have some functional issues, but for that we have dev, test, acceptance, and production. At least the build will not fail. You'll have a product that can be automatically installed every night, every day, meaning that at least you can go ahead and do your test and find functional bugs and not have something like, oh man, the build is broken and I'm looking at a non-working website. All our entire test team can no longer work. They better go home for the day because we need to fix the build. Of course, that's definitely going to be a big hindrance to your productivity. So we have no out-of-branch dependencies in here. That's, of course, painful, no out-of-branch dependencies, because a developer, what does a developer do? I'm working on an app, and that app is using a business component, and I'm also putting that on a web page somewhere, and I want to debug everything in one go. I want to press F5, man. I want to press F5. That's so easy. But you don't get F5 if you have a lot of dependencies. So we chose to create something known as integration solutions. That is basically any solution file, doesn't matter how you name it, as long as you put it into the solution folder, you can reference any project in any branch, anywhere, we don't care, whatever you want to go ahead and do, and it will allow you to go ahead and debug and build many products in one go and have one debugging experience to basically go ahead and hit the code from the app and from the site in one debugging session. So that's definitely going to be an ease of use thingy that we want to go ahead and provide to developers. And TFS, well, doesn't even see that they're there, so TFS doesn't care. It's all good. So TFS doesn't break, and developers still have an easy time developing stuff. But it's really not so simple, because if you check out what we have over here, we have an app and we have a site, right? If you check out my site, I will show you that in Visual Studio. So go to Visual Studio and go to my integration solution, which I have over here. There we go. It is preparing my solution. It seemed to be prepared already. If I look at my demo site wingtip, it has a reference to my app. But it doesn't have a direct reference to my app. Instead, it's pointing to the folder of my website, the dev branch, the main branch, to the binaries folder, and to the DLL that we have in there. So if I go to disk, you would also see that inside my website product, I have my main development line, and I have a binaries folder, and there I have the version of the script demo that I support. So basically what we now have is a website pointing to a bin folder, and here I have the app itself. So what happens if I go to the app, and I'll make an API change, right? So you go ahead and do that. Whatever you go ahead and want to do, into J is probably a better letter for me to use today. So what I do want to go ahead and see, if I built this, I would love for it to pick up on the latest version of that app within the reference of the site. But the site is not pointing to the project. So if I go ahead and right-click this project and it would build it normally, that DLL would not disappear into the binaries folder. It will just go ahead and go to the debug/bin folder of that particular project, and there it's going to sit, and nobody's going to use it. It's not so useful, right? So the thing that we chose to do is start using Visual Studio extensibility to provide us with a means to go ahead and copy our DLLs to the places where they are needed. And how do you go ahead and do that? Well, for this, we have created a tool that we're going to open source as well, and we call that tool the Project Builder. And basically, the Project Builder is a tool that I have over here. It's basically a whole bunch of PowerShell scripts. And I've got two interesting PowerShell scripts for you. The first one is the post-build script. Because the post-build script, what will it do? Well, it's going to retrieve the path to your solution. It's going to retrieve the assembly that you've just compiled. And what I'm going to go ahead and do is use basic object model of... this is not even using object model of TFS or VS projects or whatever. I think it maybe actually gets TFS workspace. So we're using all kinds of object models to figure out, hey, wait, if I build this one, it will find that this one has a reference to it. Then it knows that this product over here sits in a product folder because we have standardized the product folder layout. It knows that the solution file is within dev source solution. That's where all the solution file lives. So now it knows where the solution sits, and by virtue of us standardizing the folder layout, it knows that the binaries folder is two folders up into the binaries folder, and it can find the DLL that I just built over there. So what it's going to go ahead and do is going to go ahead and look all of that stuff up, basically. It's going to find that binary in that bin folder in another product. It's going to say, hey, let's copy it over there, so they have it too. But then again, it is a DLL that is TFS bound, so it might be read-only because it's not checked out yet. So we remove the read-only flag, and we copy that DLL into that place. So if we then build the demo side wingtip, we're actually going to see that API change, and we can go ahead and make use of that. Of course, it is all dependent upon the build ordering that you do. So one thing that in integration solutions, developers must take care of is the project build order. So it first should be the app, then the site, and not the other way around. So if I go ahead and do that, make an API change, and I think I have a use API thing over here as well. See, currently it's saying, oh, that's all well and good. If I now go ahead and right-click this, say build, the post-build event is bound to the post-build event of the project. So we're going to go ahead and wait for a bit, and it's going to compile the stuff, and it's going to copy it down into my site where it's being referenced, being used. So it knows that, hey, it's getting the workspace, and then it finds that, hey, in this folder over here, demo/wingtip, there's a project that uses it, so I'm going to copy it to the dev bin folder, and all of a sudden you see that this line now fails, doesn't compile anymore, by virtue of me changing that API. You do notice that I'm not really using TFS right now. I'm not putting it into TFS. Why not? Well, I would break the build, right? Because I first need to fix my using project before I can actually move forward and actually put all of the stuff into TFS. So I can go ahead and fix my API code. You can actually figure it out by building, and it says, hey, it doesn't really use that, so need to figure it out. Oh, wait, yes, it has this new important parameter called J, and it always needs to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 1. That's really important to have that value in there. So now we can build this one. And basically, this is a hierarchical system. So if you have a business layer component that is being used by an app, that is being used by a site, if you put your build order correctly, it's going to just go all the way from, well, the root of the hierarchy back to the leaf level, the things that is using that. That is basically for your local builds, right? You still need to go ahead and put stuff into TFS. And now it becomes more difficult because your coworker, they also changed my API and they added another parameter in there. And of course, if I now go ahead and say right click, check in, done, right, that is definitely not going to work. What every developer knows that works in a team, before you check in, you must always get latest. If you don't do that, you have a good chance of, well, getting check-in conflicts, stuff like that happening. You might, well, stuff happens, not so nice. Usually just do a get latest and then you can go forward. But then it becomes more difficult because we have this binaries folder. Usually you check out a file, you work on that, and as soon as you're done working, you check it in, right? That's how, well, basically we work with source control systems. The painful thing about putting DLLs into binaries folder, bin folders for managing dependencies, is that TFS by virtue is not able to merge any actions that pertain to binary files. You cannot merge a DLL with another version of a DLL and hope to actually have an API that works, right? DLLs cannot be merged like source code can, right? TFS can auto-merge stuff. You add a method, you add a method, you say just go ahead and stuff works. DLLs, it's different. So the difficulty that we then have is, well, in order to go ahead and not have to merge a DLL, when we put stuff into TFS, well, that does mean that I would then have to first check out the DLL, then do all the copying bits over here with the post-build commands. But here's the crappy thing. If you check out a DLL, you cannot check out a DLL. It's a single-user checkout. Different than source code files, text files, single-file checkout, single-person checkout. So it's not really nice, because if you do that, and your coworkers also wanted to work on the same set of products and things, which you have quite quickly because you're all working on a large-scale whatever app, then you're going to hinder a lot of people. So what we chose to do is, no, please don't check out DLLs until you're done. By the time that you're done, that's going to be good. Now you can. But we want to maintain as short as period as you can with checking out DLLs and working with that. We also want to ensure that developers actually do a get latest before they check in. And all of this stuff is usually something that developers must remember. And remembering is usually bad because, well, as with everything that you need to remember is, well, you forget about it. So what we chose to do is add another tool in the project builder set of tools called Integrate. And Integrate is similar to post-build. It is only way more advanced. So what you go ahead and see is we have created the Integrate tool as another PowerShell script. There you go. This one is actually using a lot of TFS and Visual Studio Environment APIs. So we are able to parse project solution files, SLN files, to find all the projects. We are able to call into TFS to see if stuff actually exists in TFS. We can call get latest. We can compile projects using MS Build. So we basically now created a one-stop shop for developers that if you have changed an app and you have integrated that locally into a site and you want to throw all of that stuff into TFS with all the changes that are already in TFS merged into your code as well before you check in, that's a lot of stuff that you need to do. Right, you must say get latest, compile, if it fails compiling, fix what is broken, go ahead and do another get latest, la 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 la. That's painful stuff, but you do need to do it. And we basically hit all of that stuff into one command called integrate that we have actually integrated into the Visual Studio UI as well. So what will happen? If I hit integrate, it will first go ahead and call get latest on this project. So all of the changes that are already in TFS will be pulled locally. Next, I will compile this project. If it works, it compiled. Next, it's going to see, okay, who is using this DLL, similar to post-build. It's going to copy the compiled app into that location. It will then call get latest on my site. It will then compile my site. If that works, it's going to check out the DLL out of TFS. That is now a lock. Right? Only one person can check out a DLL in TFS. So now the project is locked. Nobody else can integrate at the same time. That's good. So only one integration step per go. Otherwise, you'll have a lot more complexity to manage. And basically, as soon as that is all working, everything is checked out, built, working, it's going to say, I'm done. You can check it in now. And now that's everything that a developer needs to do. So we right-click on this project over here, and we say integrate. And it's going to do a whole lot of stuff for me. So this is something that our developers do quite a lot of the time. As soon as you make an API change that can cross boundaries of projects, meaning as soon as you change anything that is public. or protected, for that matter. So we see Project Builder going on over here. It sees all kinds of reference being found. It's checking out my DLL. It's doing get latest on all of these things. It's now compiling my project to see if no other developer has made any breaking changes that is also breaking my build and that I would need to go ahead and fix up before I check in. So compile, compile, compile. And it's actually go ahead and in the end says, well, that's it. I'm done now. You can now check in your changes. And now you can actually check in your pending changes, which will also include stuff like DLL somewhere over here, right? So if I go over here, somewhere in my changes, there you find my script demo.dll. And you can also see that it's currently locked by me. And the good thing is, if there's two developers wanting to integrate at exactly the same time by chance, only one of them is going to have the luck of being able to do that. The other guy is going to hit an error saying, cannot check out the file, so please wait until that file is unlocked again. And of course, the biggest pain point is the developer saying, oh, I'm ready to check in, let's go to the bathroom. Right? That's not something that you should do. Probably go ahead and check in right now. So why don't we auto-check in? You can do that. It's one line of code. But auto-check in checks in every change, or you need to be really smart and start figuring out what stuff changed by virtue of this script, which is going to be difficult. So we were like, yeah, well, let's have the developer do that, and then they can put in a sensible comment as well about the stuff that has happened. So we're not really doing any automated check-ins at this moment. I am going to undo all of this stuff because it is not stuff that I really wanted to be doing anyway. There we go. So this is something that we have in Visual Studio. And that is only development, right? We're not even moving into test acceptance and production. This is just to get DLLs correctly built, not even installed, but only built and put into our source control system so that we can have a team working on a set of products in one go. I have worked at other companies as well that have a similar approach that uses SUPST as a central drive to copy stuff to. Only the thing about SUPST, if you say all the DLLs reside on the D drive or the X drive or whatever, well, you can only SUPST one folder, meaning if you have many projects that need to go ahead and integrate together, there is no hierarchy in there. So we chose to use PowerShell instead as a little bit more advanced system to go ahead and work with this. So that Project Builder tool is also the tool that we use to actually have developers install stuff on their local machine. And that is all driven from the support folder. So another trick that the Project Builder has inside itself is something known as a whole bunch of installation files, complete, install, recreate, uninstall, uninstall this, uninstall that. And basically there's some granularity in there. Install installs everything, all the dependencies, every component, any product that you need to work together. Recreate site only deletes the site collection and runs the scripts to recreate the site collection. It's kind of handy if you only need to do that stuff, right? You change the WSP or just the web part and don't undo a full rollout. And rollouts of everything can take quite a lot of time in our environment because we have a lot of stuff and a lot of dependencies, at least like 40 WSPs, and can take quite some time to install 40 WSPs on a multi-server farm. So there's some optimization in there. Basically, what I can do is I can hit complete on that. If I want to go ahead and flatten and re-begin, right, throw everything out, re-begin, you just hit complete on that, and it's going to load up Project Builder in the non-integrated vision, not integrated into Visual Studio. It's just going to run inside PowerShell, which it's loading up. And it's using the Project Builder. And what it's going to go ahead and show me, it's going to show me a list of all the products that need to be installed in order to make this website work. And what it's now doing is saying, hey, guy, if you want to do a full rollout, do you want to do it using a local solution that you're building? Or do you want to get the latest stuff from TFS from your teammates? And sometimes if you're doing changes and you're doing a lot of changes and you don't know if the full rollout will still work inside other people's machines, it's kind of good to test that without checking in. So then you can say, okay, I want to do a local solution file. It knows where the solution files sit because we have a standardized folder structure. It's going to say, okay, which one of these two solutions do you want to compile and run? Well, I want to compile the non-integration solution. Do you want to have a get latest on that, yes or no? And basically, it's now going to go ahead and go to the installation sequence on my local box using the specific versions of code that I have in my machine that don't even have to be checked into TFS yet. Of course, if you choose TFS drops, then it's going to take the latest build from TFS that you want to go ahead and work with. So usually our developers come into work, the first thing they do is say, complete, and it's now trying to uninstall, but hey, it's complete on bad, so it's uninstalling. There is nothing to uninstall, so it's skipping past that stuff. It's saying no, 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 and it's using all kinds of actions that we have standardized. It's not in the solution store, and now it's going to get to the installation bits, right? And we have something for installation too. It's called the project installer, which is our second companion in terms of installation stuff. And let's see if it still want to do an uninstall step, or by this time it should be just about done with uninstalling that which is not installed. It doesn't really see that natively or quickly enough. Remove the WSP. Yes, there you go. And there we go. Now we move towards installing all of it. And usually our developers come into work. They don't have to do any get latest themselves. They just hit complete.bat. And they say, latest TFS drop, that's the nightly build that we create. And then they go get coffee. And because our installation sequence takes about 15 to 20 minutes, with all the things that we want to go ahead and do clean, note that we do clean installs on developer machines, no upgrades, because otherwise it would be super painful. Go from version 1 to version 9, you need to do like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like 8 upgrade steps. That's going to be fun. And then you can like have a coffee, have lunch, go home, and then you can work the next day, reinstalling the next daily build. Oh, wait, you can go back home again. So we have quite a lot of stuff that it needs to do, and now you can see it's compiling my project. It's doing everything locally. And, of course, this do-it-locally approach is something that developers do usually when they are developing during the day, right? And sometimes you haven't really changed an app, you have only changed the site. So instead of uninstalling and installing everything, we have all kinds of optimizations. So if you check out such a complete.bat file, let me go ahead and swap stuff out a little bit for you. What you see is we run PowerShell, we point to the project builder with the run installer script, and we say, I want to install the apps and the site, I want to install and uninstall it, which is, of course, uninstall and install it, not the other way around. That would really suck. You're like, nothing is there. How can it be? Well, if you run install last. If we check out something like install.bat, it's the exact same. Point to the run installer. This time we say we want the apps and the site, but this time we only want to minus install it, not uninstall. If you check out install site, it is something similar. We have run installer. This time the component groups only contain site, and we point to we want to install it. So you can have a little bit of separation of stuff that changes often and doesn't change often and basically work with that, and then ensure that you have a quick as installation as you can, because something that every SharePoint developer knows, it takes a long time to install stuff on SharePoint, and it's usually a good time to get coffee, right? So try not to do full installs the whole time, just small ones. So how does it know what is an app, what is a site? Basically, we have defined an XML file, and this XML file is the place where we basically define our dependencies. So every product has a components.xml which defines itself and the things it is dependent upon. And what you find in here is a components file containing a component group named apps. You can think of your own funky names if you want to call it wilder stuff. And non-router stuff, well, that's all well and good. But we have apps and sites usually, and we have BLCs, business layer components, so we have a few groups in there, basically to separate stuff out. And you can basically uninstall and install per component group. So the granularity sits in how you define your groups. You might have one product in a group, you might have many, doesn't really matter. And in order, just to give you a little bit of insight how many we have, usually the site contains one product. Usually the app contains about 6 or 7 products because we have 6 or 7 apps that we reuse. And next we have business layer components sitting on top of that, and we have about 15 of them accessing different backend systems of the pension fund, right? Customer systems, pension information system, blah, 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 all kinds of WSPs that expose that and have web service proxies in them, stuff like that. So developers maintain this. What you then also see is the version. And this is interesting because on your local box, what version do you want to have? Well, the latest one, of course. The very last build is what I want. But what you want to have when you install stuff into test? Definitely not the latest build. You want to have the build that you specify. So instead of current, you're also allowed to put in a version number, and that version number also corresponds to folders within our TFS drop folder and within our release folders, and basically it plucks out the correct one and basically works with that. So what we make our TFS build do is when we put out a TFS build, my TFS build goes out over here. If I have wingtip, you can see that I have a whole bunch of builds over here. And what we basically made the build do is every build creates a version folder and it also copies all the stuff into current, meaning that is always the latest build in there, and basically our tools can point into that. Now the developers don't need to know what the latest version is. And we also have an installation mode, which is interesting because we want to do full installations on dev environments, but we want to do upgrades in TAP, right? Test, accept, and productions. You don't want to do flatten it, throw away all the changes that your business guys have made. You want to go ahead and upgrade WSP and have upgrade scripts. So install mode is full, is the non-default. The default is update. And basically that would run update scripts instead of uninstall install. And full means uninstall, delete it, install anew. Meaning that you have a totally clean environment that should always basically work at least within development. Right? That's where we are right now. If we go back to Project Builder, it has now done it. What you can see, it is doing a installation, well, a whole bunch of installation stuff up here. Next, it's going to go ahead and install my demo site wingtip. How does it know what to install? Well, very easy. We also standardized the naming schemes of our installation scripts. So when it hits full, it's first going to go ahead and say, is it installed? If it is installed, I need to run install or uninstall web app, uninstall global. Now it's gone. As soon as it's gone, I need to run install global, install web app. Right, so we have standardized the names of these installation files so that we can always find them. Meaning that every product is always installed the exact same way. Meaning that in order to get new products in there into that system, it's going to be lightning fast. We can have all these dependency checks and all of the stuff that you will get out of Project Installer basically by virtue of naming your files in a certain way. So what does it all do? Well, install global, that's going to usually add the WSP. So it's going to point to an action file, solution add. And inside solution add, we have an action. It has an action mode. Why do we have an action mode? Well, basically it says, do you need to hit yes in order to go ahead and do that? Does the installation guy needs to say yes on all the steps and not just say F5 and hit it? Because our installation guys were used to saying, just hit it. And they don't think about what's actually happening under the covers. That's a bad thing. So all these actions are steps that you have to okay or not okay. And of course, then installation guys get tired from saying yes the whole time. So now we introduce the yes to all switch, which is kind of strange in comparison to the run action mode that is asking you to say yes or no. But hey, stuff happens. And it's going to do the add solution. And of course, adding a solution is a global action. If you have a WSP that is globally scoped, then it would also contain the install solution action. But my WSP is not globally scoped. It is web app scoped. So we have a solution install, which is going to action as the next thing. So these files you can name any way you like. These files, starting with installer, need to be named exactly how they are named. So we have solution install that does the install solution to a particular web app. How does it know the web app? Well, of course, we don't know the exact address for this environment. The address is different for dev, test, acceptance, and production. We have different URLs for all, because at least we can then hit the acceptance site and compare it against the testing site to see if it's the same, right? It cannot be the same URL, so it needs to be dynamic. And of course, our dynamic things is something that we put into environment-specific rewrites. And here you see a rewrite being used, redaction URL, right? The site URL. And it's going to install this WSP. Next, it's going to run recreate site. What does that do? Well, it's going to run before deploy script. It's going to set the site owner, and it's going to deploy into this site area. This site collection will be deleted. It's going to add a sandbox WSP into the new site collection, and next it's going to run an after deploy script to actually get stuff deployed. So if I check out what all of that stuff does, I will open up this thingy over here, Notepad. So what do we do is we basically get the parameters in there from Project Installer, and we basically have installed a WSP, which is sandboxed. Or this is the after deploy. I should have the before deploy, which is first. So what we're doing is we're going to find where the site collection is already there. We're going to delete it if it's already there, which is kind of good for clean rollout on my local box. It's not so good for production. Delete site collection. Every page that anybody has created at any point in time is now gone. Painful. And in the end, we're going to create a new site collection without any templates applied to it. So in our between, before, and after deploy, we install a sandbox WSP. That sandbox WSP contains our site template. And after we have updated that site template and put it in there, we can then say site.applyWebTemplate and update the web. And now we have basically a site created totally afresh, done. And why do we do that sandboxing? Well, one of the painful things that we find about SharePoint is that whole sharing nature. If you create a site template for a very specific site, right, a pension planner site, you're only going to have one of them in the entire farm. What I don't really like is to make that into a visible template, right? That's going to be painful. You don't want to do that. I want to prevent feature visibility as well. But you usually do have a few visible features. So the stuff that we did is everything that is visible and scoped to that site collection is something that we put into a sandbox WSP. Between the before and after deploy, we put in that stuff into the new site collection, which hasn't had a site template applied to it. And then we apply that site template. And because our feature definitions are inside a sandbox WSP, there's only going to be one site collection where they will see those visible features, namely in the site collection where they're being used. Right? So that's really good for keeping SharePoint clean of stuff. And something that you find quite quickly, if you deploy stuff globally, you make stuff visible, and you need to focus on that. You need to make every feature invisible until you need to have it visible, not the other way around. The default is wrong. Right? So therefore, we have all of these things basically running the way that you see it running over here. And therefore, I also have, inside Visual Studio, basically my normal code, and I have my publishing. And publishing is special because it's a sandbox solution. And nobody wants to write code in a sandbox solution, as we all know, because that's painful. You cannot do anything. So basically, this is the way in which we can start having installation sequences, steps, and moving that into at least my local machine. And we also use the same approach to start installing these things into our project SharePoint server. With us, every developer gets his own SharePoint machine, and we also have a project-level SharePoint farm, which is basically for that one particular project, and of course we need to install on that stuff too, and we basically do exactly this, only if we use Project Builder, and there is no solution folder, because there's only like the installation from TFS, it's not even going to ask you if you want to do the local solution file or the TFS, it's just going to take TFS. And then we use the Windows scheduler to basically schedule the complete.bat call. And basically that's being scheduled in the morning. So every day we come into work and we get a fresh SharePoint site with all the latest bits, the entire installation, with every change up to the day before, up and into the day before, which is kind of good. Right, post-build. So here you see our staging environment. We have our local machines, a whole bunch of those. Per project, you'll have a project server. Next, we have even one more environment before we go into TAP, which is a cross-project environment. And why do we have the separation? Well, basically, here's the stuff where developers end. Developers with us don't have any permissions on TAMP. We don't even have the password. I cannot open PowerShell, I cannot go to the server, I cannot do anything. Why is that? Well, as soon as you give everybody access to your TAP environment, it's going to be difficult to find out who created all the crap that you see on it, right? So we want to go ahead and prevent that. We have a separate group of people that install stuff and maintain server availability. And they do that from the T onward. So we do need to have a place where all the stuff that will come together within T needs to also come together within an environment that the developer can manage and debug. Visual Studio is on there, on the shared dev. There is no Visual Studio on T. You cannot do remote debugging. If we do remote debugging, we install the remote debugger, we fix the issue, and next we flatten the machine, reinstall the Hyper-V image, or we're using VMware, and then we can go ahead and do it again. We don't even allow you to debug on it, because as soon as you do that, well, that's the opening for more crap in your machine and strange stuff happening. We don't want that. So then we get into SharePoint and then to the difficulty, because say that you have two teams. And what is difficult over here? Well, say that you have two teams, and team one is using a shared component, and they're using version one. And team two is using a shared component, it's using version two. By the time that you hit the shared environment, what version do you have over there currently? What version do you want to have? Do you guys know what version of code you have installed in your SharePoint environment? How do you know that? Not all WSPs contain code. You can have a DLL-less WSP. You can do that. So the big gap of SharePoint is something that you may have already seen 2 seconds ago, is versioning. There is no versioning of stuff that you put into SharePoint, which is totally insane. It's really strange, actually. So the first thing that we needed to do is say that you are building a product and you're dependent upon version 2 of an app. You want to be able to define that, and you also want to be able to find out where the version 2 is already installed on a particular machine. Or perhaps version 3 is already installed, meaning that you now have a higher version that you wanted, which should be good, right? If you maintain backward compatibility, there can be only one DLL, meaning that, well, you have to create backward compatible code, otherwise, well, stuff will always crap out. So you do need to be able to ask the question, what version is installed? And for this, we have created a particular and a very important tool in our environment, because it's allowing us to find out what we have installed. So if I open up Central Admin, and if I open up PowerShell, no red letters here. Let's see if I can now do get SPSAR. That's good. Works again, right? Fixed my machine by deleting more stuff. That's what usually works. Delete more stuff. What we have is a special command called get product info. And what does it do? It prints out the versions of all my WSPs, the version that it can find out. Not everything, like the claim provider that craps out on me, the crappy claim provider. That doesn't have a version in there. And it also finds all the assembly versions, and I can even do something like select minus expand property assembly versions and point that into format table. Now it's going to print out all the DLLs that I have on my machine deployed into SharePoint, all the versions and file versions for it. There you go. Now you know. You guys probably don't know yet. Well, this is actually very important information to be able to steer how you can upgrade certain bits on your farm. So we created a bunch of commands for this, and how does it know? Well, we also have the user interface of SharePoint, right? If I put this back to a normal level, we have a little button over here called installed versions. It's basically doing the exact same thing. And of course, there you see versions, and you can scope it down into web applications to see only the versions of products that are deployed into this particular web application, meaning that if you have a lot of stuff, you can filter it down a little bit and not be bothered by too much stuff in your face. How does it do it? The first thing that we wanted is not to have any code to actually do the versioning, meaning that it needs to have an intrinsic version per package. if a package needs to run a put a version into the registry or into a list or into whatever storage place that you can think about, well, if that code fails, then your versioning doesn't work anymore and it's going to be painful. So what we chose to do is every product has a certain file in itself called the version file, and developers need to add it, and basically that's called version.txt. And our TFS build knows that the version.txt is always in the version folder, is always named version.txt, and similar to upgrading the assembly version on each build, we will also put that build number into this file before we package it using normal packaging of Visual Studio or of MS Build. Meaning that now we have an intrinsic version inside the package, inside the WSP, and I can show you that. See, if I go to C colon, build TFS, SP demos, and if I take whatever build, number 13, lucky number, and here I have my WSP wingtip. Let me go ahead and not break the stuff. Rename it to cab. We have a version.txt. Copy it over. And basically there we have the number 13 as well, right? The thing is that this file is something known as a package-only file, right? It's configured as package-only. And the funny thing is that when I was doing Visual Studio, which I was doing for, well, almost the earliest bis that you could do, it's like package only. Why the hell would I want to just put a file into a WSP? Who wants to do that? It's usually a feature manifest, or it's a layouts file, or a template file, or whatever, right? It's usually not package only. But here you have a use for it. You can package intrinsic information into your WSP, and then you can extract that stuff as well. And that is also how we do the versioning. We have a project called the versioning project, this one over here. Right, that's no longer in the place where I want it to be. Perhaps it's over here. Yes, it is. And basically what we have over here is something known as the versioning manager. There we go. And the versioning manager, it's using expand.exe. It's going to go into my entire farm. There we have all the solutions. And it's going to go into each solution. It's going to create a temporary directory. And in order to delete that, we have created iDisposable stuff to make it all sweet and sexy in code. And basically, it's going to extract all of the stuff out of the DLL. It's going to extract the DLL for the assembly versions. It's going to extract the version.txt all into a temp file. And as soon as it has done that, it's going to aggregate all the information. And there you have your versions. Boom. Right? It took a little bit of work to actually get that. But now you have intrinsic version per package without you actually needing to do anything else. But as soon as you add a solution, you know the version of that stuff inside SharePoint. Doesn't even have to be deployed, right? An add solution doesn't fire any code. It just adds a DLL or WSP into the configuration database. So using this information, we can now start to do advanced stuff, interesting stuff, which I have only a few minutes for to explain to you what we are doing. So let me get back to the slides. So we have product versioning. We have something about staging. Here you see my rewrite file, right? You saw the rewrites being used in the installation XMLs. And here you see two of them. Basically what we have got a file called rewrites. And next we have a file called rewrites underscore T, rewrites underscore A, rewrites underscore P. And they contain different values for different things. For instance, the site owner, that needs to be a particular developer, so we hooked into the environment variables, meaning that we have user domain, username, that's usually me. If I install, it's going to be you. When you install, you'll be the site owner, you can get in there. But within production, we make it one of the administrative users, that they are the primary admin of the site collection. You can see differences in the URL, wingtip minus O, wingtip minus T, meaning that we have particular sites. And we actually even put the letter T into the environment so that we could use an environment variable and have no duplication of those letters even at that place, right? But that's just something that you can do if you want to do that. So if we now move towards installation, we already seen Project Builder doing a local install of stuff. And in order to actually go ahead and move forward, it's probably wise for me to... I think I can do it this way. We also have something known as Project Installer. And this is the tool that is actually driving the installation. Project Builder is using Project Installer to do the installation bits. And Project Installer is the thing that understands the XML files and all the action that it contains. We have just a whole slew of actions, including BCS actions, PowerShell, claim stuff, right? You can define all kinds of actions that are interesting. And usually, you just point to an XML file and say, execute a sequence of actions. But then again, we have this component file that defines our dependencies, including the versions that we want. Well, currently you see the version current being applied, but if I go back into my environment and not into TFS drops, because sometimes we have a drop where we say this is going to be a release, right? This is going to be a releasable product. We want to go ahead and push it out into production. We're going to create a release, and we have a separate folder for all the stuff that we have released. Usually it's not the dev branch. Usually it's a release branch in TFS, but I was too lazy to create one of those. And if we see over here, then you see the rewrites that are being copied down from the support folder, the components files being copied from the support folder. You see the debug folder indicating that's the debug build. We have our installation commands, and we have all our bits, PDB files, WSP files, DLLs, everything. If you check out this component file, now it's going to say, I want to install version 0.0.17. And that particular exact version is the thing I want to have. So let's go ahead and start Project Installer in the component installation mode, because that is the thing that is helping our installation crew the most. So we have Project Installer. If you fire it up without any commands, it's going to fire up in user interface mode. And it says, okay, well, what do you want to install? And we support you pointing to specific installations. It's going to, oh, wait, UNC path, that's true. The installation bits, if you point to an installer file, it needs to be a local file, but you could point to one of those. Or instead, you could say, I want to point to a component file. There you go. That contains particular versions of stuff that you want to install. Usually, it's going to ask if you want to perform each action. That's going to be tedious and boring, so everybody clicks yes to all, no user input, because I'm, well, not really looking forward to saying yes, yes, yes the whole time. You point to the rewrite file that you want to use for your environment. And of course, usually we have a few of these, so it's going to be rewrite minus T. And of course, our installer knows that he's on a T environment test, so he points to the T file, easy as that. We have an installation document saying, choose the right one. It's really advanced stuff that you have in there. And now we say start. And now the most fun thing of these installation tools is going to show up, because now we get the complexity. First of all, the installation guy doesn't know what he's installing. He has no clue. Does it go into the GAC? Does it go into the bin? I don't know. How do you know it? Need to extract the WSP and look inside of it. Who's going to do that, right? Nobody. It's going to go ahead and figure out whether the installation or the upgrade mode, every WSP has got an upgrade mode where you can either say recycle or reset. Recycle IIS, smart. Reset IIS, dumb. What's the default? Reset, exactly, dumb, too bad, fail. And we're going to say I want to deploy into Wingtip server. And here we get into our installation impact screen. I'm kind of lucky to have like really wide screens at my work and not like small ones that you guys are looking at right now. But inside the component files, it sees that I want to install these two products. It sees that I'm currently installing the dev branch and not a release branch. So if this is going to be the T, our installations guy is going to say, well, dev, you didn't create a release in TFS, meaning the source code that we're installing is not separated out. For T, and it's not going into production, that's good. But as soon as you go to production, they're going to say, no dev allowed. You need to create a release. You need to go and create a branch in TFS. Otherwise, you don't have the source code pertaining to this installation anymore. It may have been changed. Actually, it will have been changed because we have many teams continuing development. It knows what version is currently installed. It knows the version that I'm asking, right? The one is in the component file. The other can be read by get product version in PowerShell. So we do that. We can see that it's a debug build. We can see that the reset web server mode is not set. It sees that it's going to do a start, stop, and upgrade, IIS reset. It sees that it's doing GAC deployment. It's really sucky, this installation actually. It's doing fail on upgrade, and it's throwing stuff into the GAC. Oh, man, the most painful installation that you see. So we have all these big yellow letters up there saying, oh, this is bad, that is really bad. And of course, our installation guys will now go to you and say, dude, if I install this stuff, you do know that my 20 websites will be down for 2.5 hours. I don't have that maintenance window. Why are you throwing stuff into the GAC? Well, they have never considered throwing something into the bin. I don't want to do CAS policies or whatever. And then they say, well, I'm not going to install it then. Bye-bye. And that's kind of the virtue of having a non-developer installing stuff, because every developer would say, go! Then I'm done. And of course, that's not what we want. And then the project installer is going to figure out the install mode. It's going to figure out that, hey, since version 19 is installed, and since you're asking for a minimal version of 17, well, that means do nothing. And since we have version 000 installed, you want to move to 015, that's going to mean that you need to full install that, retract deploy, or when it's not installed, well, just install it. Next, we can modify these steps, although that's something that we do not expect people to need to do, but sometimes in extraordinary cases you might want to, so we provided an action saying, let's modify product number 2, code council wingtip, it's being currently installed full, what do you want to do? I want to force it into full install, boom, there it goes. You can also do that for a script demo, and then I would have version 17 applied over version 19, meaning that you would downgrade stuff. That's something you can do. If you hit continue, it's going to say, ready to go? You sure? You sure? You sure? Want to go? There you go. Woo. Hey, Mr. Installation Guy, have you noticed that there's a dev branch in there? That's usually not allowed. Do you allow this? We log your answers, right? If you mess up your farm and they just said blindly yes, well, I don't care what you're asking. Just say yes, and of course, the installation guy is going to have an issue. It says, hey, debug build, not good, should be released. Do you want to allow that? Yes. And there we go with project installer again, moving forward with all the actions of all the products, of all the things that you want to get into that version. That was my talk on how we install stuff into SharePoint. Ah, man, that is so not cool to have red letters with your final demo. But stuff happens, right? Let's see. The given path is in a format that, I probably know that. Probably going to be a slash somewhere that I forgot or whatever. But basically, this is our approach. So we have tools to support you inside dev to do structured installations into production, where you have many different versions of many different things working together, where you don't know the exact environment. And basically, here we have the tools to provide you with the insight to do this. And it's going to be on Coplex soon. So thank you for your attention. Hope you enjoyed it. And have a good day.